Stay tuned for The Cinema Clash as Maryland-based critics Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl debate the merits of new releases, from the mainstream movies that Hannah tends to favor to obscure foreign films that Charlie likes to champion. It's free-flowing, unedited conversation with an occasional wine wager. Two very different perspectives, one entertaining podcast. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to The Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net.
Hannah, what's on TV?
On TV is the Nats game, game three of the World Series against the Houston Astros. And so we need to keep this quick because we got to watch the Nats finish the fight, man.
And how many games are they up right now?
They are up 2-0, and they could wrap this thing up Saturday night. I'm hoping for a sweep.
And to accompany us, we are drinking a terrible bottle of wine.
It is indeed. Thank you so much for this pretty bad wine.
And I left the bottle upstairs, so we don't have to shame any company or anything. This wine is not for the taste, it's just for the effects.
Okay, sounds good.
All right, we survived. We survived the Middleburg Film Festival. Personally, I thought it was a wonderful experience. I just love that particular film festival. I love the location, and I saw mostly pretty outstanding films.
Yeah, I didn't find it to be as... the film slate to me was not as moving as these films have been in the past, but it was a combination of solid movies. So they were all decent. There were very few duds. But I did not find myself absolutely crying at any of these films. Where in the past I've done a little more misty eyed. I think
I teared up once.
There were a couple of scenes here and there. Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. I think there was a little bit.
Twice. Very good. I forgot. I teared up twice.
And there was one other. A little bit in Waves, maybe, but not really. I'm not really sure.
Well, over the next couple weeks and months, well into the Oscar season, these films we saw will onesies, twosies, dribble out into theaters. And they're all going to be, you know, limited releases. None of them are really going to open wide in 4,000 theaters, say like Terminator will next week. The first one really to do it, it already opened last week in like 5 theaters, New York and L.A. This week it added 50. I'm talking about Jojo Rabbit. Personally, my favorite film of the festival. Last week in our On Location podcast, I extolled its virtues. I was still on my contact high.
That's right.
From the film. So we're not going to beat this to death.
Right. We'll sort of carry on. Hopefully you've had a chance to listen to our special On Location from Middleburg podcast. You can certainly catch it up on demand. But Jojo Rabbit is still worth a re-mention because it's that good.
To remind you of where it's coming from, writer-director, Taika Waititi from New Zealand himself, a Kiwi, he's done 3 films that the Cinema Clash loves. What We Do in the Shadows, which was a vampire mockumentary, and it's now a sitcom on FX. I've seen the first season. It's really good. Hunt for the Wilder People.
Loved it.
Ricky Baker. And he jumped to the big time. Marvel noticed this guy had some chops, so they gave him Thor Ragnarok, which is considered one of probably the top 3 or 4 Marvel installments to date.
And he's in that one as well, and he's just really funny.
I wanted to talk about the kids in Jojo Rabbit. I didn't really talk about them. I didn't know too much about them. They shine, specifically little 10-year-old, he's British, it's his first film ever. His name is Roman Griffin Davis. He plays little Jojo. And he does such a good job. He's got some really heavy scenes. He's in every scene. I don't think there is a scene without Jojo in it. And he does some really heavy lifting, and it's almost that he's young enough he doesn't know how big it is. Mm-hmm. And he's playing opposite Thomasin McKenzie. We remember her from last year. Mm-hmm. She received huge acclaim. From Leave No Trace, where she starred next to Ben Foster hiding out in the woods.
Yeah, she was excellent in that.
These two are just phenomenal. One, a Nazi wannabe, thinks he's a true believer, nationalist fanatic, and one, a Jew hiding in a wall. And how they spark off of each other and react off of each other is wonderful. And the other child, who's also garnering a lot of acclaim, is Jojo's friend, and he's played by Archie Yates, also, I believe, his first film. And he's just so...
As Yorkie.
Funny.
I even love his name.
Hysterical. He's just, He's so practical and level-headed and says exactly what's going on. It's like, you know, it's not a good time to be a Nazi, Jojo.
Yeah, he really has no connection, no affinity so much for the ideology as he really does for just wanting to belong. He's just a kid. And so, you know, he's sort of just following along and just sort of, you know, he's a buddy of Jojo. And they're just trying to make their way in this particular scary world.
And they all want to follow along. They all want to be part of the club. They believe they are true believers. They believe this. They're just too ignorant to know. Another thing I learned, since I now have a week between me and when I saw it, I didn't know it was an adapted screenplay. I assumed it was original, but no, it's based off a novel called Caging Skies by a lady named Christine Loynens from 2004.
Mm-hmm.
This won the Audience Award at the Toronto Film Festival, and that is a big deal. Those tend to win Best Picture.
Yes, except I would also note that from going back to Middleburg for just a minute, one of the films that we missed that won the Audience Award for Best Narrative Film was The Two Popes, which I'm hearing could very well get in there and be a Best Picture. So I think there are things from Middleburg that we may have missed that actually will be front runners as well.
Jojo Rabbit, I understand, I get it, has its haters. There are people who just will not, refuse to, even if it is funny, they refuse to laugh at Nazis. They refuse to laugh and go along with the satire, the biting black comedy humor of poking fun at aspects of 1945 Germany. They just won't do it, and I get it, that's fine. Maybe that's why it has a 77% Rotten Tomato score. This is scoring a lot higher with audiences than critics, because I believe there are that 20% or so critics who do not accept World War II comedy.
Yeah, they're going to be turned off by it, but this is not a conventional comedy at all, and so you need to sort of embrace the weirdness. It is very odd, and you have to just get into it, and once you sort of understand the way the satire is playing out, then you absolutely can appreciate this film as it progresses, and it takes some turns that are certainly not funny. You know, it is dark in places, and the satire makes it way more digestible, I suppose. And Taiki Waititi as Hitler, you know, he's a buffoon, and so you got to appreciate how Hitler is being portrayed in this particular film as this imaginary friend of Jojo. And so you take it as a total package, and it's very timely, I would say, even for a 1940s war film.
And lastly, before we move on to our next film, I want to point out the excellent use of song in the film, especially anachronistic songs. Very early on, there's a German version of the Beatles' I Want to Hold Your Hand. Come get me your deine Hand. It's so catchy. And then at my perfect scene at the end with Bowie, Heroes, the songs just work so well.
And a quick shout out to the supporting cast. I mean, it is a Sam really Rockwell strong ensemble. Scarlett Johansson. You know, yes. I always love Sam Rockwell. And Scarlett Johansson as JoJo's mom is getting some buzz, even though she was also in A Marriage Story with Adam Driver that we saw last week. To me, this role is, you know, really just such a departure and an interesting role for her. And so I love that. And Rebel Wilson, I mean, every time she's on screen, she's just fun to watch.
Do not forget that German culture is the superior one in all the world. Now let's go burn some books.
That's right. She's a hoot.
All right, our second film, oddly enough, both films that we're leading off with this week are black comedies. Our second film, we briefly touched on it, was the first film we saw at Middleburg from South Korea, Parasite, from director Bong Joon-ho. We know him from Okja and Snowpiercer. Okja and Snowpiercer were both on my top 10 list for their respective years. I love this guy, and a lot of people love this film. It won the Palme d'Or, which means it won the Cannes Film Festival. Not easy to do. It's the first Korean film ever to do that. And it's the first unanimous vote to win that award since 2013.
Wow.
It has a 99% on the tomato meter, 219 fresh versus 2 rotten.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, this is a critical darling for sure. So I'll be curious. My parents did see it last week and they loved it. I was really wary about them going in to see it, but it turns out they really enjoyed it. And as much as it's a dark comedy, it also has some interesting stuff to unpack in there that I think is just really worthwhile. Parasite, some people are turned off by the name and are assuming it's some horror movie about like organisms infecting human bodies or something. It's not that. Parasite is a metaphor for sort of the mooching of one class upon another and maybe both classes on each other, and upstairs, downstairs gone way, way, way awry. And so I think it's just worth noting that this is a film that if you are into guessing what the foreign film for the Oscars will be, you kind of got to see this one, because I would say there's a 99.999% chance that it will get the foreign film Oscar.
I believe it will. Speaking of class, I didn't take it away at first. I had to ruminate on this and think about it for a couple days. This film is really about capitalism. In fact, I think it's kind of anti-capitalist. It's really displaying the haves and have-nots and what one class is willing to do to get to the other side, how one class feels about the other class, whether conscious of it or not. Smells come into it.
Yeah.
It's not that overt, but I really believe that is what he is saying.
Yeah, there's greed is a theme in here. Discrimination is a theme. It does take a rather gruesome turn towards the end, but it is one of those films that you can kind of ruminate on, and it does stick with you a little more than your average film.
So after our On Location podcast last week, I took my family out to dinner, but you went to see another film. What was it?
I did. It was the Saturday Night Centerpiece, which was the film that I think very well could be just really one of those fan crowd pleasers of the award season. It was Ford versus Ferrari, or Ford v. Ferrari, and it stars Matt Damon and Christian Bale. So that alone was enough to get people pretty excited about this film. This is a true story that I was not aware of, that basically you had these two racing legends who were really good friends, and they were basically brought into the fold to help the Ford Motor Company come up with a car and race that car against the legendary Enzo Ferrari team in the 1966 24 Hours of Le Mans race. And so it's about that underdog sports story, and with these two racing legends, Carroll Shelby and Ken Miles. Really interesting story. The friendship between the two is really at the heart of this film. And so I do believe that you don't have to be a motorsports fan at all to get on board. And so Ford versus Ferrari is definitely one of those crowd pleasers to keep an eye out for in the months ahead.
Who gives the better performance, Damon or Bale?
You know, both are being considered for the best actor category because neither one is more of a lead than the other. And I think they both give equally good performances. They play so well off each other. And so it's a really tough call. I think they might cancel each other out because they are both just equally strong in this film. And they're so much fun to watch.
Every year at that film festival, they celebrate a composer. This year it happened to be Terrence Blanchard. He was there supporting the film Harriet. He wrote the score for that. But on Sunday morning, we went and we listened to him play his trumpet, and he was backed by the DC Pops Orchestra and his own band, the E Collective. And he played wonderful samples from Spike Lee movies. He does more than Spike Lee, but he is mainly known as Spike Lee's score writer. He played his trumpet to scenes from Malcolm X, which was very moving. He talked about stories behind Inside Man and Miracle at St. Anna, which I had actually forgotten about since I saw it way back in 2008. Really haven't thought about it since.
And When the Levees Broke, really powerful scene shown there.
He tells very personal stories about Hurricane Katrina and how he responded to it and his family and what Spike did. Kind of the idea for that documentary. It was very well received. You know, he talked about the score, the music is the soul of the film. It's the conscience of the film. Without it, you really don't have a film. And it was really only about an hour and a half long, but it was so well done. I took so much away from that.
Every year, it is a highlight. It is one of the few things that absolutely sets the Middleburg Film Festival apart from other festivals, is that musical celebration of a distinguished film composer, and they give out that award. And 3 years running now, I think I've gone to that. And it's just every year, one of my favorite parts of that festival, often way more than the films themselves, because you just feel like you are witnessing something very special. And so with Terrence Blanchard, it was a joy to kind of listen to him and listen to that music.
Speaking of sound, you passed a documentary on to me this week, and it's called Making Waves, The Art of Cinematic Sound. And it's not just score, it's more than just Foley, which we've talked about on this podcast before. It's all sound. And if you ever get confused at the Oscars about sound editing, sound mixing,
sound design,
this will clear it up for you. This is not your standard documentary. This could be, you know, just a class, an undergrad class or a high school class. This is that educational. It's very educational. It's actually more educational than enjoyable is the wrong word, but free-flowing.
It's informative for sure.
It's actually directed by a sound editor, Midge Costin.
Yeah.
You know that name from Armageddon, The Rock, Crimson Tide, Broken Arrow. It's got heavy-hitting interviews. I mean, the A-list of people, the people who really brought sound to where it is. Sound used to be, we learn, just a thing. You just throw some sound on it. Here's the stock sounds, the bullet ricochet, the scream. And then people like Francis Ford Coppola, George Lucas, Steven Spielberg, began to understand sound in a different way. And now, after watching this documentary, I understand it in a different way as well.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's got Barbara Streisand and Sofia Coppola and Ryan Coogler and all these, directors who brought music into their films in different ways. And this is a girl power documentary in many ways, because it's not only directed by a woman, but they even have in the production notes a female cast list, and it, aka, this is what you get when you have women making films. And so very impressive list of women contributors to this film as well. And I think, didn't they try to relegate like those sound editing and sound mixing kind of categories to the commercial breaks last year, 2 years ago? And there was this uproar within the industry, and this film helps you understand why. Because these directors are saying, you know, this is how you can really, this is a long and costly post-production process to really incorporate music that, as Blanchard said, you know, it speaks to the soul in these films. And so it's 50% of the film is what, you know, there's what you're watching and what you're hearing. And this documentary absolutely helps you appreciate what you're hearing.
Well, we learned, you know, Walter Murch, he was Coppola's guy. He really kind of kicked it off. Mm-hmm. And then a man named Ben Burtt took it over.
Star Wars.
He invented the lightsaber swoosh sound and what R2-D2 sounded like.
Yeah.
And then Gary Rydstrom took it over for Pixar. I learned, my favorite takeaway, and there's a lot of facts and takeaways from this, I learned that Top Gun, the fighter engine, sounded wimpy. So she incorporated jungle animals, tigers and cheetahs and lions, into the engine noise, and they play it for you. You're like, oh my lord.
Yeah.
There are animal noises in that F-14 Tomcat engine.
Yeah, C.C. Hall did that. And it is fascinating when they will show you what the natural sound picked up by the camera is.
Which it turns out it's nothing.
Is nothing. And then what you are hearing when you are watching these films. And the difference is phenomenal. And it also just goes to show you how, you know, sound, just like imagery, can be manipulated to really change your emotional response to a particular scene. So when you see like that, that long opening scene from Saving Private Ryan, and you understand like what went into the musical choices for what was going on under that. Just a really, really interesting documentary.
It reminded me of the Foley one we saw. I had to go back and look up the actual title of that. Actors of Sound, a Foley art documentary. And that was Making Waves is a lot better than that. That one's strictly Foley, and you get to watch how they make those crinkly noises and those metal banging. And that's a small part of this
film. Yeah, but I actually learned in this film that Foley experts really are creating custom sound effects that you might not otherwise be able to get. And so you absolutely learn it goes to great lengths to sort of break down for you the differences so that you're not just thinking it all, you know, it's not all like meshed together, that there is a process here. There are different types of sound, different types of scoring and sound effects that come into play. And it just absolutely helps you appreciate all that. And then you start watching movies very differently than you did before.
It also has 100% on the tomato meter.
As well it should.
Now, you caught up with a film that's currently on Netflix. It had a limited theatrical run, but now it is on Netflix. Anyone can watch Dolemite. Eddie Murphy
is my name.
In Dolemite is my name. How is Dolemite doing?
Dolemite is doing pretty darn good. It's groovy, man. It took me back into the 70s. I did not know what to expect from this film, but a friend of mine was watching it, had posted something about the fact that he was really enjoying it. And so I was like, all right, I turned it on and I started watching. And I'm like, wow, this is really pretty good. I mean, I'd heard, you know, people are calling it like a comeback film for Eddie Murphy. And it is certainly he really is very good in it. And I was not an expert on blaxploitation crime films of the 1970s. So I really did not know about the original Dolemite movie from, I think, 1975. I remember seeing the poster. Like, the poster is a very memorable one. But this is a biopic about this guy, Rudy Ray Moore, and that's who Eddie Murphy's playing. And he was this scrappy guy. He was trying to make a living as like a singer and dancer and comic, and nothing was really coming together for him. And then he found success once he kind of adopted this character of Dolemite, kind of a pimp-looking, you know, flamboyant dude on the streets of L.A., in the black community there. And he just went out and he made his own luck, and he created his own character and took that for, you know, took a leap with that and managed to become sort of this pioneer in the four black comedians in the years following. And so it's really just a pretty funny, and just also interesting biopic, very different from so many of the biopics we've seen recently. And it reminded me a little bit of like the whole of The Room and Disaster Artist, because you're sort of seeing the making of this very quirky Dolemite film within this movie. And it's just really fun to watch. It's got one of probably the craziest sex scenes that you will ever see on film, and so it's one that I think you might want to catch up on, because it's quite entertaining, and it's streaming on Netflix now. You can just watch it from the comfort of your own home.
I'm gonna throw a marker down. I have not seen Dolemite, but there's no way the sex scene in that film is crazier than the one in Midsommar.
I never saw Midsommar, so I can't be sure of that. But
yeah, I think you'll probably receive it as a screener, because it's going to be pushed by A24 probably for awards. And so here it is. I'll watch Dolemite. You watch Midsommar. We'll come back and you're going to agree. You're right. Your sex scene is crazy.
Absolutely. And Dolemite Is My Name has a great supporting cast. I mean, you've got Keegan-Michael Key and Wesley Snipes and Divine Joy Randolph as Lady Reed, who sort of... who becomes kind of a comedic sidekick to the Dolemite character. And it's just a really well done film. And it just is one of those ones that's inspiring in its own weird way. It just makes you feel like, you know what? Don't let anybody keep you down. If you believe in yourself and your talents and what you can accomplish, and you just go out and you make it happen. And he did that. So kudos to him.
All right, before we wrap this up with what we didn't see or what we will see next week, I have a movie-related, what is your feeling about this? Because I just read it about an article about an hour ago, and I wanted to get your reaction. Joker, which so many people thought might spur violence, but has actually only spurred the gentrification of a Bronx stairway. Because everyone's going to that stairway to take pictures. It is now the highest grossing R-rated film of all time. Not R-rated horror, not R-rated comedy. R-rated film.
It beating Deadpool.
Deadpool 2. It's number one. Do you care? B, does it matter? C, does it mean anything? Or D, does it mean everything?
No. No to all of the above. I don't really care. I don't think it matters. I think it's just going to be a fleeting kind of thing. This is not one of those. I just don't see people going back and rewatching Joker all that many times in the future. I think it's more of a societal kind of, we've got to go see this because all, you know, it's like a DC Comics film, so everybody's got to see it just because. And so to me, Jojo Rabbit has more to unpack than Joker does in terms of what it has to offer and what lessons learned for you know, just society. Even Parasite, I think, has more to unpack. And so I'm kind of disappointed that these smaller films get so overshadowed by something like Joker, and just because it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy that a film like that, based on, you know, based on a huge fanboy reaction, I guess, that it does so well. But I don't see this having all that much impact in the future. At least I hope not.
I'm with you that Jojo Rabbit and most of these smaller films are better than Joker. However, we do have to acknowledge, we have to accept the reality that box office does also equal awards attention. This guarantees, if it was a question, it guarantees Phoenix a Best Actor nod.
Oh, absolutely.
Box office absolutely impacts awards attention.
No, it does. And we even mentioned that going in, that we thought Joaquin Phoenix put himself out there as most likely.
And he did. And now that it's number one of all time, I think it solidified his status as one of the five.
Absolutely. He will be nominated, and there's a very good chance that he will win. There are a lot of good performances, though, still to come. I mean, the two popes, both performances in that. Although all these films that have, like, two really good leading men will make that lead actor category really hard.
Well, I've heard from Popes, I've heard it's going to be Jonathan Pryce. There's also Adam Driver from Marriage Story. Yeah. DiCaprio will be the actor for him Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Brad Pitt was placed in supporting.
Yeah, and that's just it. It's like you look back and you go, oh, right, I forgot about DiCaprio.
And the dark horse, ya boy, Taron Egerton is right there on the outside looking
exactly.
in.
Exactly. I mean, from Rocket Man, there are times where it's like, oh my gosh, I forgot about that film. And that's what's going to be really interesting as we move a little further ahead in award season, because you go, and we get those For Your Consideration screeners again to remind us of some of the things that we saw over the course of the year that deserve to be recognized and should not be overshadowed. But then, you know, there's also, do you keep Tom Hanks out of the mix? Because he's really good in A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. Will that? But
he's actually kind of a supporting actor.
He is. He is. I agree. But he's just a Hollywood favorite as a nice guy. And he's playing this insanely nice guy. And so there might be a little bit of room for him. I don't think he should necessarily be in the top five for this one, based on all these other performances that I've seen so far. But I think that actually is going to be one of the toughest categories. And in the end, I do suspect that Joaquin Phoenix will walk away with it.
Well, Jojo Rabbit is pushing little Roman Griffin Davis for Best Actor.
You know, go for it. He doesn't have a chance in hell. But,
why not?
But hey, you know, give the kid his due.
All right, we did not see Countdown. Apparently, it's about when you learn the exact time you're going to die, and our heroine learns she's going to die in like a day and a half or something.
Okay. We also didn't see The Current War, Director's Cut. Or The Current War without the colon, Director's Cut. I have no idea what the difference is really supposed to be, except that apparently it did not have it wasn't received all that well with the originals, and then the director's cut was released. And so I'm shocked. I do kind of want to see it because, again, the cast, it's got Benedict Cumberbatch as Thomas Edison, Michael Shannon as George Westinghouse, Nicholas Hoult as Nikola Tesla, you know, all about, I don't know, electricity stuff.
I heard it's pretty dull.
So I heard it's not so electric, apparently. But man, what a shame because it's just a really, it's a great looking cast. But yeah, apparently it kind of is fizzle.
We also did not see Black and Blue, which is coming out on 2,000 screens. But we already had the screener from like a year ago. Neon sent this in their package. And I never got around to watching it. And they held on to it. They held on to it for like a full year because they thought it had potential. So now they're finally releasing Black and Blue.
Oh, I didn't realize we had the screener so I could go back and find it and
watch
it.
We do have it, yeah.
Oh, okay. But the other one that I did, because we were at Middleburg, I missed the screening invite for a Fathom event called Showing Western Stars. And gosh, Charlie, do you know who stars in Western Stars?
Is it your boy?
So Bruce Springsteen, the boss, it is a cinematographic depiction. It's a concert film. And basically, it's a concert film of his album called Western Stars. And so I have to see it eventually, but I did miss the big screening on a big screen to really appreciate a concert film with the boss. It's been a, you know, the boss is on a bit of a wave here, and so we'll see if he's able to capitalize on that.
Well, we're gonna split up a little bit next week. You're gonna go see Edward Norton in Motherless Brooklyn. I'm gonna go see Linda Hamilton in Terminator: Dark Fate. And we've already seen Frankie.
Yeah, and I really am bummed that we have not been able to see Harriet. I'm hoping somehow that becomes a possibility. And Earthquake Bird launches on Netflix, so I suppose we could, and so does The King. Neither of those movies particularly seems to have much appeal for me.
I've heard very much about The King. I know that's Chalamet as Henry
V. Timothy Chalamet, yeah.
But I've never heard of Earthquake Bird.
We got a poster for it, but yeah, as much as I love Timothy Chalamet, the trailer does nothing for me. I was not a Game of Thrones person, and well, it looks like it'll be good for like Game of Thrones
It looks
fans.
Like they remade Orson Welles' Chimes at Midnight, because there's Henry V as Hal before he becomes king, and there's Falstaff, and... Like, they remade Chimes at Midnight. I've seen that movie, and it sucked the first time.
maybe we can count on our listeners to watch these Netflix films for us and let us know how they perceive The King and Earthquake Bird while we go and watch pick up the slack on some of these ones hitting the theater.
Just a very brief wrap-up, just to remind everyone that Jojo Rabbit is awesome and is the best film in theaters right now. Now, you should go out and see this amazing story.
Yeah, I do agree with you there, Charlie. Jojo Rabbit is quirky, it's weird, but it is the payoff is there. You just got to stick with it.
It is, very much. All right, well, thank you very much for listening to this episode of The Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
The Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl is heard twice each weekend. At 5:15 on Saturday and 12:15 on Sunday afternoon. Join us again next time for The Cinema Clash.